Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with Ian Pekarski of CMF Metalworks. Ian is an old friend of the show, but if you're not familiar, he's known in the custom knife circles for his organic designs, his finesse with fine materials, his thinly ground, beautifully profiled blades, melt-in-the-hand ergonomics, and a barely-there flipper tab that works like a charm. CMF Metalworks knives are coveted among collectors, but not the easiest to acquire, so Ian has set out to change that. We're going to catch up with Ian and talk all about it. But first, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell. Download the show to your favorite podcast app so you can listen while you walk out the door. And as always, check us out on Patreon. If you think what we do here is valuable and you want to support the show, you can check out the exclusive content, the knife giveaway opportunities, and other stuff there. Just go to thenifejunkie.com/Patreon and check it out. Again, that's thenifejunkie.com/Patreon.
The Get Upside app is your way to get cash back on your gas purchases. Get Upside is an app you put on your smartphone, and whenever you need to get gas, search your area for savings, claim your discount, fill up your tank, and then take a picture of the receipt with your phone. And that's it. You've just got cash back. Visit thenifejunkie.com/save on gas to get the app and start saving. Again, that's thenifejunkie.com/save on gas.
Visit the Knife Junkie at thenifejunkie.com to catch all of our podcast episodes, videos, photos, and more.
Ian, welcome back to the Knife Junkie Podcast. It's good to see you, sir.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I wanted to get in touch and congratulate you on your market penetration, shall we say. You've been making these beautiful custom knives, handmade, each one, one at a time, for a number of years, and you've really built up a head of steam with a fan base and collectors, and then there are people like me who admire your designs from afar. Well, you've made it possible for people like me to own your knives, and I want to talk about it. So tell me a bit about the print.
So I am particular about the knives that I'll put into production. I think we talked about that last time. I don't want to do any of my main lineup custom designs, and it's just a personal thing. So I spent months designing and refining and talking to people a model that I would make, you know, into production. Sorry that this one's dirty. I use it to fix some stuff, but this is what came out, and I think it's got you know, it's kind of a mixture of that Daedalus that you had on the last podcast, as well as a little bit of the Crusade. And then a model that I don't know that a lot of people know about called the Affair. It was one of my models from 2019, kind of my first dive into like the really curvy handles and kind of trying to go more slim. And I wanted to make something, you know, that was mine, but that would only be production. As well as being a canvas for modding. And, you know, I wanted it so people could swap out the thumb studs. I wanted it so people could swap out the pivots. The bearings, if they want to. I mean, it's. I even got rid of the floating backspacer, so it'd be easier for people to take apart. Uh-huh. I don't want people to take it apart, but just
you know they will.
To. I know they. Oh, absolutely, they always do.
So the idea behind keeping your custom models custom and your mm-hmm. production models production and ne'er the twain shall meet. That is a smart idea because it seems like it maintains the value of both.
Yeah, I think so. I think to me, it's more, I just don't want to put my custom designs overseas. I mean, these are being made by Riot. And then, you know, on the other side of the spectrum, I have the Matte Crusades, which, is one of my custom designs, but it's being, machined, all the parts being machined by HMC Knives in Erie, Pennsylvania. Jim Vandeveld, great guy, great machinist, but everything is USA made. The steel is sourced from a company in Texas, SB Specialty Metals. The titanium is from a company in Ohio. All the hardware is made in, I want to say Montana, by Tie Connector. I get my belts from a company in Ohio. All of Jim's machining tools, I believe, are from Lakeshore Carbide. which I'm pretty sure is a USA-based company. But I know I did as much as I possibly could to make everything about this USA-made, which is why I felt comfortable doing my custom design for it. The price point's obviously different.
I'm going to say this is actually really, really exciting because we've had so many conversations on this show with makers trying to do what you're doing or wanting to do what you're doing in OEMing a, well, I mean, I guess you're not OEMing, you are assembling. Are you assembling these Mac Crusades?
Yeah. So he sends me the way that they work is I get, finished machine parts, with the exception of the pocket clip, which I have to finish myself. But basically this is all machined. There's pocketing on the inside. The pivots are just plain pivots, and then the blade is unground. The lock isn't cut. There's no detent. So I'm hand grinding these. I'm finishing all the parts myself. I'm doing lockup, detent. All the action is, my standard action that I have on my knives. It's not someone else doing it. As where this is, this comes finished.
Right. Right. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is, in a way, it's like a mid-tech. Remember, we used to talk about mid-tech a lot.
I think that's such a hard word because everyone has such different definitions for it.
I know. My definition for it was the correct one, which was exactly what you're doing. having all the parts made, but you're the guy who puts it together. It's your action. It's your grinding. And, I think that is really, that's great. That's half of what we've been talking about here. There's this idea. Wouldn't it be great if we could have a robust OEM knife making community here in the United States? Right now, the financial end of it doesn't quite work. But that's what everyone would like to achieve at some point. And that's not to say anything bad about amazing companies like Riot and Best Tech, who just do amazing work. But that would be nice to be able to do here.
I mean, Jim has a great thing going. He's doing phenomenal work. He knows machining. He knows the knife community. And I can't wait to see what Jim is doing in even a year's time. I mean, the stuff he's doing now is incredible, and I can't wait to see him expand and get, more USA made knives.
So he's kind of into the mix. In Erie, PA.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. All right. So
it sounds close, but he's actually it takes more time to drive to him than it does to my parents in Vermont.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I used to live in Cleveland and, Erie was close by. But we were talking before about how Pennsylvania is such a great knife state. You have a lot of, Bradford and then just a lot of knife makers kind of sprinkled throughout.
Yeah. There's a fair few here.
Yeah.
More than I thought even last year.
Okay, so I want to talk some more about the print. I want to get back to the print for a second because snuck up on me. Frankly, I follow you on Instagram, and for some reason, I don't know, maybe I just wasn't in a spending mood and I wasn't seeing new things. But tell me about that process and how it differed from say doing the Mac Crusade or a full custom.
I mean, it was just kind of making the prototypes. I did a pass around. I made the initial design, and then I made the first custom, and I brought it with me to, oh my goodness, I made it right in the midst of COVID, so it would have been 2020. So I didn't bring it with me to any shows. I did a pass around for it. That's what it was. And I had people give me feedback on it. And then I made a second prototype, passed that one around, made a couple changes, and that's the one I ultimately sent out. And then it was just, waiting game, prototyping to come out with, this finished design.
What were the results? What were you hearing from the pass around groups? What were the kind of changes you made to the initial prototype?
I mean, sometimes I have to remember that my hands are just made of calluses. it was chamfering here and there, slightly larger, can never remember the word, just like little cutouts for your thumbs to unlock stuff. Different thumb studs we went with. I found that these thumb studs, I'm actually trying to go away from them and kind of go more towards this style.
Oh, okay.
Just because I feel like they're a little easier to get a grip on. Nothing major, just some small tweaks, changes, small placement pocket clip type deal, just so it's more comfortable in the hand.
Okay. The reason to me, it's just kind of funny because I had that Daedalus. You loaned that to me. Father of Icarus.
Yeah,
I learned.
Yep.
Oh God, it's so beautiful. But it was so refined and it felt so good in hand. And it was such a, you know, very, very high end piece, you know, that I'd ever held, you know, and to me, the idea of kind of coming back with a criticism of it, seemed a little funny because it has its own internal logic, you know, none of it, you know what I mean? That one on top is just beautiful, by the way.
I didn't get to see which one that was. I don't remember.
It's that one.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's a Paladin.
Paladin.
That is a, one of the first like three or four.
I'm looking at the Paladin when we were just back up there looking at that. It reminds me of a, doesn't remind me. It, to me, it looks like next generation of a certain movement of knives that came 30 years ago. Who are your influences?
I feel like we maybe touched base on this before, but when I got started, Tough Knives is who initially taught me kind of like the basics of making knives. And he introduced me to, you know, Rob Carter. I think at that time, I unfortunately can't remember the guy's name. Neil Blackwood. That's, you know, Neil Blackwood, I think, was still making knives at that point. Jeremy Marsh, Dalibor, Lee Lerman. You know, these kind of guys, I had no prior influence into the knife world at all. Mm. So, I mean, seeing those over the first couple years and trying to design my own stuff. And then, I mean, now when I design, I try not to look at anything.
Yeah.
Like I try not to follow any knife makers, any significant amount on, at least on Instagram or whatnot.
Right. Right.
Just, I don't want their work to influence mine at all.
Yeah.
I am not self-proclaimed as a PhD level redneck engineer. That was actually given to me by one of the admin in my group, Jordan O'Neill. And, because he saw that I made most of my parts with a hand drill until I got my lathe, a couple years ago.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Please don't get me wrong. I wasn't trying to suggest that your designs are derivative in any way. I was looking at that Paladin and I was thinking, man, that's got the grace of a master design like, Ken Onion. You know, it doesn't look like a Ken Onion, but it has that same organic flow. And I see that throughout your designs, but it's not, that can oftentimes be a turnoff because it means immediately that your hand is going to be forced into a certain position. You're going to have to use this knife the way, you know, just one way. And yeah. I don't get that from this. So you've got both of those aspects in there.
I actually do a bit of my designing based off the curves of your hand. Like where your lines are, like where you sit. So for like this knife, I'm not gonna be able to show it, but the way I have it is so it sits right where your hand folds in. So the secondary hump, you don't actually feel it. Your thumb just sits there.
And that curve down towards the pommel nestles right into that muscle of your thumb there.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not catching that at all. I love it when people get one of these and they're just like, I don't even feel that second hump. Like I thought it was going to be sharp, but you don't feel it at all. And that's kind of the same deal with the print. I designed it to kind of fit directly. Where am I going? Sorry. Okay. I'm all over the place today. To fit in your hand in between all the, you know, where your hand creases.
Yeah. The ergonomics of it. And then the thin blade, the one that I had, the Daedalus that I had for a short period of time, had a very thinly ground hollow. It was a hollow grind, if I remember correctly.
Correct. Yep.
So I noticed on the print, you went with a flat grind.
The final product does have a hollow grind.
Oh, it does. Okay. So that's a prototype you're holding.
Swap that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of the prototypes.
Okay. So how do you, is it always hollow ground for you and why?
I started off hollow grinding. Rotten Design, John Sorensen, he helped me when I first got started into modding knives and gave me a lot of pointers on how to hollow grind, how to freehand hollow grind, just how to get that wheel to work for me. And it's just kind of stuck with me. I practice flat grinding, you know, once every couple months to make sure I can still do it. But I just love hollow grinds. I think the blade ends up being a little lighter. You get, I think, cooler patterns when you use Damascus, because you are thinning it out towards the bottom, especially like on a sand mine. Unfortunately, I don't have one here to show you. I don't know. I think it's slicier. I love them.
I do too. I just love to even look at them. I mean, they're great to use, and you know, you're not going to want to use it to baton wood or anything stupid like, you know, anything overdone like that. But I love the way they look. Honestly, when I got my first cold steel Tanto in high school, that was part of it. It looked like a big giant straight razor to me with that hollow grind. And so it's always kind of been, you know, an appealing thing to me. But now in my older age, I realize the practicality of it and how you can sharpen those kind of, you know, for a long time before, you know, before you need to really reprofile it.
It's funny. I know that each grind kind of has its own place. And as far as collecting goes, at this point, I really only collect I really only collect fixed blades. And this was actually one of the first knives that I ever got. Not this one exactly. Back when I got started, I actually had to sell the one I had to pay my rent. But I was able to get another one because this knife just meant so much to me. This was the first like knife that I purchased. Back in 2015 or 2016, I bought it for $20 at a yard sale.
Wow.
And it just got me into fixed blades, which got me into knives. But this is where I learned like my love of flat grinds. I don't love them on my folders. I think that my hollow grinds just work better with my designs. But a good flat grind is just spectacular. And I just love really any fixed blade with a flat grind is going to win my heart.
So if you're only listening, Ian just held up a Nimrvis by Benchmade, and you got that for $20 at a yard sale. That's a screaming deal, man.
I did, yeah, with the sheath and everything. This same one, the black Cerakote. For anyone who is listening, it's the Benchmade 140. If you want to see what it is,
Benchmade 140. So, what other do you collect? Mostly production fixed blades, or do you have?
I prefer custom ones. This is a kid named Will Freeman. Have you heard of him before?
I don't think so.
So he is like he was, I think, 13 or 14 when he built this.
Oh my.
I got it Blade Show of 2019.
Oh, good Lord. That is beautiful. Big recurve chopper thing. God.
It's W2 with a Hamon. And it's just perfect. It's gorgeous. It has a feathered Damascus guard here. I don't remember what the wood is, but I mean, the kid is incredibly talented. If any of you are looking for a fixed blade, I don't know if he's still making.
I am.
But Will Freeman Knives.
Wilt.
Yeah. Will.
Will.
Just Will.
Okay.
Yep.
That is, you know, that would fit beautifully on my wall back here. You know, it kind of reminds me of a Filipino kind of recurve thing. Love it, man.
No, it's good. It's good to go on the belt too. I mean, no one says anything when you're walking around Walmart.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
Got one more.
It's like, do you have any registers open?
Yeah, seriously. This is Alex Garcia out of New York. He made this for, sorry, I use all my fixed blades pretty hard. So they're all just kind of covered in tape. he made this for me in New Jersey in 2018, I think. And it's been my shop knife ever since. But his knives now are just spectacular. He's another one you should check out. Alex Garcia.
Alex Garcia. I like the look of that too. I like a nice chisel grind. I know people tend not to like them as much because they're a little weird, but man, they can get so sharp. And
crazy sharp.
Yeah. And if the chisel is on the right side for your handedness, so to speak, it works great. That's something that always stuck in my craw about the Emerson brand, a brand that I love. I love Ernie Emerson and his designs and everything. And I even love that they're mostly chisel ground. All the edges are chisel ground anyway. But he puts it on the other side. He puts it on the left appropriate side.
Yeah.
Strictly for aesthetics. I mean, he told me that and I don't like that. It should be the other way around.
No, I've only made two chisel grinds and they've both been for right-handed people. So it doesn't bother me having a flat, you know, on the show side. I think as long as that side is finished in the same way, I think it looks really nice.
Yeah, I do too. It's a good look. So were your chisel grinds special requests?
One of them was somewhat out of necessity. And then the other one was a request. The first one, I had a piece of Armor Core Damascus that I accidentally had surface ground on the same side twice. Oh. So the core was actually all on one side. And it made for a pretty cool knife because I was able to, it's a lefty. So I lied. It is on the show side. But this way you have the core all along the back, and then you have the core on the show side, but the edge is all core. There's no pattern steel. And it looked really cool.
Yeah, that's
once the podcast is over, I can try finding it for you.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. So we're talking about materials, and I mentioned in the intro how your use of materials, that's something you're known for, because it's written all over your knives. They're really beautifully depicted in these exotic materials. And you were just showing a couple off before we started rolling. I want you to show right now. How did you go from hand drills to using some of these unbelievable materials?
I'm still using hand drills, by the way.
All right.
I have three of them in the shop. I use them for everything.
Well,
I haven't stopped.
To me, that makes things more impressive, because your knives are so refined, and yet they come, they're coming out of something that seems a little less so. So show off that one with the gold, if you don't mind. And let's talk about this.
So this is a full Mokotai frame lock with a Damasteel blade. This pivot is gold and meteorite. The backspacer is gold. And then the lock side pivot is gold as well. Gold caps, like not gold threads at all. That would just mar up and be bad. This actually also has my Ghost Flipper tab.
Oh, yeah. All right. So that's what I was talking about up front. I forgot that it's called the Ghost Flipper tab, but it's you can't really detect it unless run your finger over it, and then
there you go. Yeah. You can kind of get a glimpse of it there. This one is about one 1/32 of an inch tall. Kind of see it there on my forehead.
Oh yeah,
and then
man, I love that. How long did that take you to develop?
About a year. Just trying to figure out the geometry, trying to figure out the detent, the hole sizes, how far you press the ball and how much tension.
Right.
Like this is actually quite a large flipper tab for me at this point, which is, I feel like it's silly to say, but.
No, I know. But you can see it more than the other. But with the gold knife again, I want to go back to working with gold a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what's it like working with gold? I mean, my presumption when you said that the pivot was gold was, again, that the threads were not. It's a soft metal, but in terms of having it in that spot and in terms of shaping it, isn't it still a soft metal to have on a knife?
It is. I tend to go for lower carats. This way it is a little bit harder. We're going with 3/4 hard gold. I mean, it's still going to scar up a bit in the pocket, but luckily gold is so soft that it's really easy to refinish. And then you pair it with a material like meteorite, which is also pretty easy to refinish. And then you have a pivot that essentially you can wear in as much as you want, send it back to me, I'll spin it on the buffer, re-etch it, and you have a brand new pivot again. That's one of the beauties about working with gold, in my opinion, is that even if you mess up, you still have gold and you can sell it and get more gold.
Yeah. Or yeah. Meteorite. What's it like? Yeah. So what's the meteorite like? You said it's as soft as gold, and that seems like a great strategy to put those together.
It's not soft.
Oh.
It is hard, but the benefit to it is the finish that you see. I have a piece here I'll show in a second.
Okay.
The benefit to it that you see is all that pattern is caused by etching it. So as soon as you polish that etch off, you can re-etch it.
I see.
So like here is a piece of Gibeon. This is like my personal piece. This is one of the most gorgeous patterns I've ever seen on Gibeon meteorite. I think I have another piece here with slightly tighter pattern.
All right. I'm going to ask a question that sounds like a real noob question, but is that actually cut out of a meteorite, or is it somehow recomposed?
This is
and that's amazing. It comes like that out of the sky.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, as you can see, this is the edge here.
Yeah.
That is,
yeah, yeah.
You can that see. Is what was burning up in the atmosphere when it slammed into,
that's amazing.
Namibia.
So when you,
I want to say Namibia.
Hold that up. That has a bunch of right angles and parallel lines in it, doesn't it? Or maybe they're just off. Because they say there are no right angles or parallel lines in nature, but that comes close.
Yeah. Also, that's not true. Bismuth is almost exactly perfect right angles.
Oh. Well, those people are
from
liars.
What I remember, I could be totally wrong.
Those people are liars. It looks like the surface of the Death Star.
I actually used this on a knife and called the pivot the Death Star.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So, all right. So I'm not a
but
total
this is
nerd.
Crystallized iron. Yeah. No, it's just crystallized iron from, you know, being hot molten iron floating around in space and then slamming into Earth. It's just slow crystallized iron.
So are any of these crazy materials hard to work with or nerve-wracking? I would imagine gold might be because of the expense. Ooh, which one is that? But so do these...
This is Gibeon as well.
Gibeon.
Yeah, same as the other one, just a slightly different pattern. It's going to be harder to see because it's not as vibrant.
Right.
You can get a little bit of it there, but that's like what the outside looks like. This weighs about a pound and a half.
Wow.
Yeah. Back to your question, Gibeon is a pain in the butt to work with. It is... It's kind of brittle. It's not brittle, but it is brittle. Which sounds ridiculous, but if you hit it in just the right spot, it'll shatter. But if you take it slow and you do everything with fresh new drill bits and fresh tooling on the lathe, and fresh belts, it stays together beautifully and it's really quite durable.
With zirconium, is zirconium the one you have to watch out for in terms of? Isn't there some sort of flammability issue working with
that? Oh, yeah. Zirconium spontaneously combusts.
Oh.
Zirconium dust, I should say.
Okay. Okay, so yeah. If you have a room full of it, if you're not if you're not properly...
Yeah. It's very similar to like a magnesium fire. If you've ever seen like a YouTube channel with magnesium fires on it, that first one there on the that I just posted, that's zirconium bolsters.
Oh. Can you click on that first one, Jim? I believe that's a video.
It might be really loud, so I don't know if you have sound on. But yeah, those bolsters are zirconium, as is the backspacer. And you can tell it's zirconium when you grind it because the sparks are white hot, whereas titanium sparks are red hot.
The pivot on that, did you sculpt that?
No, that's a tie connector pivot. Oh. I just domed it.
Oh, okay.
Domed it and finished it.
Okay.
But that is a stock tie connector pivot.
Their stuff is incredible.
Steve is such a nice guy. I'm so glad to be able to support him. His pivots are spectacular. Normally, I try and go and finish my own stuff, inlay my own stuff, but I thought this build just needed something slightly busier for the pivot, and you know, Steve had just the right thing for it.
Yeah, I like it. The sort of sunburst pattern around it, because the rest of the knife is kind of dark and the like a little foreboding, and the blade itself has kind of a web feel. But then you have this sort of little sunshine spot. I like that.
It's very mechanical, I think. And I think it just adds a nice little pop.
So what materials have you not used that you want to explore?
I've used platinum just to make a couple backspacers. I'd love to make a platinum scaled knife. It would be unbelievably expensive, and it's also a catalyst, so it's not the safest thing to have near zirconium dust. But I'd love to use that. There's a type of meteorite that's kind of like a glass meteorite. I don't remember the name of it right now, but if you look up meteorites on eBay, you'll find it. It kind of looks like stained glass windows, and it's cool looking stuff. I'd love to use that in some aspect. I'd love to use some stones like lapis lazuli or jade.
Hmm.
I don't know. I'll use anything. I love working on knives, and woods are on my list of stuff to use. I just haven't had the chance. But
have you used ivory? Seems like something that would go nicely with your designs. That old mammoth ivory.
In fact, I have some like right somewhere here. I moved everything for this, and now I can't find anything.
I love the look of natural materials like wood, but especially ivory and stag and that kind of thing on a modern knife like yours. RJ Martin does that beautifully, I think. There are plenty of others, but that is a thing that always I don't know. It just draws me to it. You know, the color of that ivory next to a blasted titanium. Ah, it just looks so nice.
Oh. Yeah, it is spectacular. I'm really nervous to work with it. I've done one knife with it, but it was just a couple inlays. I have pieces set aside to do full scales of, but I'm nervous to try it. Because apparently you can't get it wet. You can't get it hot. I'm nervous to thin it out because I don't have a surface grinder or anything like that. I'd have to do some redneck engineering to my mill to get it to mill correctly. So it's just, it's less nerve wracking to work with gold than it is for me to break into my mammoth stash.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so. And it's an expensive material and the dust is supposed to be really bad for you. I mean, the dust of all this stuff is bad for you, but
I don't know if it's bad for you. I'm sure it's not great for you, but it stinks.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that too.
It is. Pearl smells pretty bad, but I've ground mammoth before, and it smells like petrified teeth. It's bad.
It smells like what it is.
Oh, it is. It lingers too. Like you grind it on a Monday, you still have that smell in here Friday.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Like a mammoth was in there doing burpees, breathing heavy.
Oh yeah, it's rough. It's rough. That's probably my least favorite knife material as far as smells go. Like you have to wear a full face respirator, but even that, your shop's gonna smell.
Yeah,
it's gonna stink. You need some Febreze.
You were talking about wanting to work in titanium, and it sent my mind in a couple of different places. First of all, I would imagine working with titanium, as you mentioned, would be nerve wracking in that the expense. You know, the learning curve would be very expensive with
I think platinum, right?
Platinum. What did I say? Titanium. Yeah, yes. I'm sorry.
Just wanted to clarify.
Thank you. Thank you for doing so. That is what you work with all the time, every day. Platinum. Working with platinum, making platinum scales. Man, you know, you got to learn about each material, I would imagine. Each material is different. And that would be an expensive learning curve. But how cool would that be? That would be a baller knife right there.
Yes. The initial cost would be crazy expensive. But even if you messed up, you know, you just sell back the messed up platinum, get a new piece. Thankfully, you know, like I said, it's infinitely recyclable. Right. That's the really nice thing about working with precious metals. The thing that I've learned about working with platinum is it's very gummy. It's almost like drilling hard aluminum. It just wants to catch at every point. And it gets hot incredibly fast. All of the precious metals get hot really fast. They just conduct heat very well. That's why they're used in electronics. It would be a long build just from the drilling aspect. Drilling, cutting, it's a tough material, but it would be very cool. Unfortunately, I don't know that most people would be able to differentiate it from just like a polished titanium. At least I'm very colorblind and I have a hard time differentiating them. But it'd still be cool. Be a cool project.
So you have these skills and abilities with these materials. And it's not just sculpting, but it's engineering and making them work as a tool. Are there other things that you would... I mean, these are kind of the skills of a jeweler in a lot of ways. These are skills of an engineer. These are skills of a knife maker, obviously. Are there other products or things that you think about building and kind of bending these skills towards outside of knives?
I don't know at this point. I mean, I'm pretty wrapped up in knives. I've invested a lot of time and energy into this, and I really love it, and I don't want to stop. So trying to, you know, I don't want to dilute myself by trying to make new products. And I'm spread thin as it is. I don't know that I could go any thinner.
Okay, so that's fun. Well, that's what the print and that's what the Mac Crusade are about. I would presume, you know, making your stuff more widely available, not only to get them in the hands of a wider fan base,
the
but to make more.
Are still pretty limited. I mean, I'm
okay
making 12 a month.
Okay,
I mean, it's still more out there than I can get to in full customs.
Right, right. You're not making 12 full customs a month, right?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. So you're able to get. So this is a way of growing your company and growing your brand. Has this been happening organically? Does this kind of pop out of necessity, or do you have a certain aim about growing your company?
Like as far as why the Mac Crusades came up,
No. I just mean, like, it seems like you're expanding, and I that's exciting to me because you have these ways of putting out knives that aren't full custom that don't take as long. How are you aiming to grow further?
I mean, the production stuff, I have another design that I've made for production. I haven't released it yet. I'm not going to until I have prototypes in hand. But I have another one of those going. It's just, you know, I want to get my designs out there. I love designing knives. Unfortunately, I can't make all of them custom. That would just be unrealistic. You know, I can't have 42 different knife models. But if I can take some of my designs and make them into production stuff that other people can enjoy while I focus on my custom stuff. I mean, I don't see why those designs should sit there unused and unseen.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't either, especially if you've got a fertile mind for knife design. Now, when you're designing these knives that that Riot builds, or that you're having different parts makers, and by the way, that's kind of like being a producer, right? Having all those parts made in all these different places and bringing it all together, you're orchestrating a production.
Yeah.
But doing all this, is the design process different? Do you design these things in CAD and send them out, or do you build prototypes and send those out?
It is prototyping. I don't know how to use CAD. I have the program on my computer and I've fiddled around with it and I can't even make a straight line. I can't figure out any of it. I'm a very pen and paper type person. And then it'll look terrible on pen and paper, but then, you know, I can visualize it in my head and put it into metal a lot better than I can draw it. So both prototypes for the print I made in metal. I made a really rough sketch, and immediately put it into metal, made the prototypes with the first prototype. And it turned out so much better than the sketch did. Just something about being able to kind of make changes on the fly. I know my geometry, I know my lines. I'd much prefer to send stuff out, like physical copies.
It's pretty amazing to me as a pen and paper guy myself and someone very comfortable drawing, that someone else finds it easier to express themselves in steel and titanium. You know, like, I could just draw this down, but why don't I just whip one up over here in the shop? To me, that's amazing, man.
I'd rather spend 3 days in the shop getting it right than sending you a napkin sketch. Yeah. It's not going to work.
Yeah. And no doubt, the people on the receiving end are awfully psyched to get a working model that they can just back engineer.
Yeah. That made it a lot easier for the print.
So you send them a prototype. This is what I want the thing to be. And then they send you a prototype back, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yep.
So what's that like?
That's exactly it.
What's that like? It's like, I just sent you the prototype. Why are you sending me one back? I mean, obviously it's to see how they make it, but what's that like?
Honestly, it's a bit weird when I send a knife out and I'm expecting to get the same knife back, essentially. And then, you know, you see these small changes they've had to make because their manufacturing process is different than mine. I mean, obviously I'm a guy with just a few machines in a garage. And they have all sorts of capabilities. It's small stuff that's kind of strange to see. For instance, one of the things to me that really stood out when I got this prototype is the thumb studs. I know it sounds insignificant, but I've never seen this before and I wasn't expecting it. But that's the hole for the thumb stud on the prototype. To put that in perspective, this is the hole for one of my customs, and this is the hole that comes in all of my customs with thumb studs on them.
Much smaller.
Yeah.
And what's the significance of that?
They're just kind of lipped. They have like a shoulder on their thumb studs. And just seeing that and having that hole in the blade was kind of strange to see. It's weird seeing your work as not your work. Like your work through the mind of somebody else slightly.
Yeah. Now to me, you know, not being you, that seems like so incredibly minor. I might not even have noticed it, but of course, if it were mine, I would have taken apart completely. So you're just talking about the diameter of the hole and the fact that they've shouldered okay. So in your opinion, is that an inferior, solution, or is that just a different thing done for manufacturing?
Not inferior. It's just the way they do it. My goal with the print model was to be able to have people kind of change out the thumb studs to whatever they're most comfortable with. They can change out the pivots to whatever they want. And unfortunately, this hole doesn't really allow that. It is just about a 3/16 hole. And so I had it changed for the final design. So it's just like a number 44 hole through, just like this one here. So basically any tie connector thumb stud should fit on it. Yeah. So it's not in fear, just not.
Yeah. 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 I got you. And also not in keeping with the spirit of the design, which is to have it modular. I see. Yeah. All right. All right. That makes sense. That's interesting to get it back, because I'm thinking, you know, of more structural changes or more, more blatantly obvious changes, but that would be, you know,
they got it pretty bang on. The only real major change I made was the hollow grind from the flat grind that they provided. And I removed the floating backspacer and opted for a solid one just for ease of taking it apart. The way that this is manufactured from them, it's even difficult for me to take apart. So we wanted to make that a bit easier.
Okay. Well, yeah. So this you've got, like, I'm just sitting here thinking about your setup, your operation. Mm-hmm. And you have... from my perspective, you've carved out a really cool niche for yourself, because you make these very, very fancy, for lack of a better term, high end, beautifully handmade and engineered knives that you have a collector base for. Your books are closed kind of always, right? Because on your website, it seems like
too much going on.
Yeah, but you've remained independent. You're one person doing this, mm-hmm. But you've got your you've got multiple projects going on where you have different tiers of where people can get your work. And I really hope that the print keeps going. I mean, I hope that's something that is self-perpetuating, because I like that idea of you don't have a whole group of employees you have to deal with. You know, you're kind of low profile, but yeah. You've got tendrils out there. And I that seems like a really good business model, because your exposure is low. In terms of, you know, negatives, but your exposure is high in terms of how much you're out there.
Yeah. It's a balancing act, just trying to knock out all the projects. And fun fact about the name Print, I'm really into photography. Mm-hmm. And the reason I called this knife the Print was because in photography, you take the photo, which would be my custom version of this knife, and then they produced prints of it. So that's why I called it the Print.
That is cool. That's great. That's what they used to do in the old days, right after the printing press was invented. You know, mm-hmm. You can't travel to Paris to see the Mona Lisa. You can buy a print of it, you know.
Yep.
I love that. That's a great idea. That's a cool name. I like the meaning behind it.
Thank you.
But that business model I was talking about that you employed, do you think that's the new way of doing things? Do you think that's going to be kind of more where companies are headed?
It definitely looks like a lot of makers right now are trying to diversify. I mean, aside from just customs, you know, I see the things that Jim is doing over at HMC with the Mac stuff. Right now, it's me and Brian Efros, and I believe he has a few other makers on the way. I think that's going to be becoming more popular. And then the print, I mean, Brian Brown has absolutely killed it with his production stuff. He's doing awesome designs. He's coming out with really cool variations of it. I want to say that American Knives, Kurt American, mm-hmm. is doing a similar thing. There's a lot of makers right now who are just putting out really great production knives to kind of accompany their customs, because unfortunately, in most of these cases, there's only one of us. There's only so many hours in a day that I can be out here working. And that goes for a lot of makers, I'd assume. So yeah, I think, you know, kind of having a production lineup, something that can still get your name out there, people can enjoy, while kind of taking some of the pressure off of us to be working ourselves to the bone.
Yeah, and from a collector's perspective,
we still do.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. You're yeah.
This is my happy place. I mean, if I'm in any mood that's not happy, I'm out here making knives, because it is what I want to do and it's what I love. And I think you have to have that passion. Sorry to interrupt.
No, please. What I was going to say is, from a collector's perspective, that's good news that a lot of people are moving that way, because I would love to have a Brian Efros designed knife that's really well made. I'm not necessarily trying to spend Brian Efros money. I'm not necessarily trying to spend CMF money. you know, no offense. When I can, I will. But my point is, until then, I would love to have a collection that is aiming towards custom. And on my way to get there, I've, you know, to have these mid-techs or OEM'd knives by you and HMC made knives from Brian Efros and that stuff like that. Like that is, I'm getting all excited here. That is a, that is the way to go. That's a great thing to look forward to, I guess I should say.
I mean, Brian's killing it with the Mac Dooms too. They are spectacular. His finish work is incredible. If you're watching this and you want one, go get one.
Okay. Well, I'm watching.
Brian, you should go get one too.
Yeah. There was a period of time right after Brian was on the show where you know, I was trying to get a knife from him and he was really cool. He's like, yeah, I'll you know, I'll fit you in. And after a while, I realized this is a big commitment. And, you know, I can't do this right now. And I definitely don't want him to fit me in and then me be like, I can't do this, you know, so.
That guy works so hard as well. And he's got a heart of gold. One of my favorite people. I'm very glad to call him a friend.
That's cool. So how would you define your generation of knife maker? And not to just put you on the spot, but, you know, like I'm old enough. I've been collecting knives my whole life. I've seen different kind of movements. And I'm curious if you have any perspective from within your.
I don't know, man. I feel like right now designs are, you know, there's a market for everything. People are going to like what people are going to like, and there's nothing wrong with that. I like the organic curvy stuff. Some people like more aggressive knives. Some people like kind of more straight line knives. And then you have, I can't remember the name of it. It was shown at Blade Show, the Cybertruck knife. And that was really cool too. And people love that. So I think right now it's just kind of anything goes. You want to make it, there's probably someone out there who's going to love it.
The cyber.
Sorry, that was a bad question.
No, I don't know
how to answer that.
No, that's a
not well, mean, anyway.
That's kind of define your generation. It's like, okay. No, but the Cybertruck knife is funny. I know which knife you're talking about. It looks just like the Cybertruck.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to handle one. It was really, really cool.
Who made that? Who is that?
I have no idea.
Interesting. Yeah, but I agree. I think there is, you know, well, if you're someone like me who has very varied tastes, that's two different types of varied, two different spelling. But if you're, you're excited or I'm excited about these times because there are many people making every of those styles that you mentioned. I love, weapony knives and I can find those, you know, I love old school. I love ethnographic knives and you can find, people making, you know, there's this guy, the Spanish knife maker, Miguel Barbudo, who makes Navajas and a lot of other things too. But his Navajas are like, that's a grail for me, as well as a Charles Marlowe, as well as an Ian Pekarsky. So right now it's a very exciting time because you can have anything. If you can afford it and find it, you can have anything.
They're really, really nice knives out right now. Really spectacular work being done.
So where does a company like, what about a company like CRKT? Are they making themselves irrelevant in that they've been coming out with knives from designers? They've been innovative for so long and been doing so much cool stuff for so long, but they refuse to come along with the materials. What's going to happen to a company like that? Is it going to be big box?
I don't have enough insight into that to have any reasonable opinion. I just don't know. I haven't interacted with them. I don't follow them. Unfortunately, it's just not something I feel I can talk about.
Yeah. Look for the new CMF CRKT collaboration, ladies and gentlemen. No, I'm just kidding. No. I mean, that would be cool. And that's the kind of thing they do. They collaborate with interesting designers. And I guess they leave it within reach for everyone. So maybe I should just shut
I think
shut
Brian
my mouth
Ambrose actually them. Just did two designs with them. I want to say it's CRKT.
Did he?
He did the Jive and he did a fixed blade design that looks really spectacular.
Me and my big mouth.
They look great. I got to handle them. But like I said, I just don't know enough about CRKT or kind of that side of the production market to really be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
Good way.
Well, you know, I realized as I was actually asking the question, there is a whole gigantic knife market, much bigger than the one that I think about most of the time, which is collectors and fine, you know, people who really spend a lot of time thinking about knives. There's a huge market way outside of that, way bigger than that, that buys that buys these knives because they use them and they need them. And CRKT allows them a little bit of style and flair and innovation. I need to remember that. That's a little snobby. That was a snobby question, but I didn't mean it to be so.
It's a fair question. I just don't know the answer, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, so what knife that you have not made do you want to make sometime? Like, what is your white whale in terms of making? Something complex, something really difficult.
Let me see if I have it above me here. I have a set of Pearl that I have been saving for a very special build. And I'd like to make a full-scale Pearl knife with a mirror polished blade and make it just really special somehow. But this is like once in a lifetime Pearl, in my opinion. It's like a quarter inch thick. It's like presentation grade. It's just beautiful. And the knife, I've been saving these. I'm going to save them for another few years before I even think about it. But I want to make a full Pearl knife, everything, fully hidden hardware. There's no pivots showing, no screws showing, no pocket clip, mirror polished blade, just clean Pearl and polished steel. And that right there is, that's the material in my shop that I look at and say, nah, not today, not today.
Not good enough yet.
Nope, not there.
So that Pearl, is that actual Pearl from oysters that has been broken down and what is that exactly?
I have Pearl shell here. I can show you what it looks like somewhere. Sorry, I didn't know I was going to need this. But a Pearl shell is, so this is a Pearl shell.
Oh my God.
This is how they get them. This is a really, really small one. I bought this just to be able, for kind of situations like this, just so I can show them. So they'll get these and they'll weigh, I think they said 5 to 10 pounds just for one shell. And that will produce like a set like this, like just like a 3.5 inch by 1.25 inch set, like just one of these.
Wow.
And that's why you don't see big ones like this anymore, because we've basically harvested all of them that are the same, that are the size needed to get pieces like this. If you want to see a really good example of how it's done, Bastion Knives from Australia, I believe, has some videos up of him getting a whole shell and actually making his own Pearl slabs out of it with a wet grinder. If you've ever seen a throwing wheel with like for ceramics type deal, that's kind of how it goes. It's just sandpaper on there. He's wet sanding it, and he's making slabs out of the whole shell. It's very cool to see.
So how did you come about this piece of Pearl?
It was actually given to me by a local collector.
All right. Well,
yeah,
we got to keep an eye on your feed and see when you're going to use that, because that knife sounds beautiful. the idea of just a high polished blade from you and then some gorgeous handle just with that, with everything hidden. I mean, that does sound like a grail knife for sure.
It sounds like one I want to build. It sounds like one I'm nervous to build. It makes me anxious even thinking about it.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. Because when I knew a lot of actors, they always said, if it feels scary, do it. And I always thought that was a very actory thing to say, but that's kind of the kind of thing you need to say to get yourself to do some stupid thing.
I'd like
thing.
It to be a little less scary. It can still be scary, but not as scary as it is now. You know,
right. All right. So, Ian, what can we expect from you coming forward? And what's the best way for people to keep up with your work and find out what's coming down the pike?
I got CCKS coming up in October. I'll have a bunch of Mac Crusades with me. I'm focusing right now on book orders, and then I'll be going out to Brian Eprose's shop to work with him for a week for the CCKS show. We got the prints coming out. We did the pre-order for them. Hopefully we should have these in like February. We'll have a few more to sell. The best way to find me and follow me is probably my Facebook group. I'm most active in there if you want to see like more behind the scenes stuff. work in progress, just, you know, some of my personal life and all sorts of random crap. If you just want to see the finished product or, you know, some more refined work in process photos, my Instagram is probably the way to go. I have been neglecting it a little bit as they've changed it to the point where, you know, nothing gets seen anymore and it's a pain in the butt to use. But I've been trying to post better videos and pictures on there, trying to be more active. So if you want to see finished product stuff, you can see that. This one was just up there. In fact, I think you showed it for a moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have lots of great videos in your Instagram feed. I'm really digging the videos because they give you a good sense of, you know, you walk someone around the knife, you give them a good sense of what it's like, especially if you've held a knife in your hand, you can look at yours and know that's going to feel awesome. All right, Ian, I know you got a wedding to get off to.
Yeah, I gotta go be in a wedding now.
he's about to get in a tux, ladies and gentlemen. But thank you so much for taking the time to join us here and catch us up with what's been going on with CMF Metalworks. Been a pleasure, sir.
As always, thank you very much, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Don't take dull for an answer. It's the Knife Junkie's favorite sign-off phrase on the podcast and on Thursday Night Knives. And now you can get that tagline on a variety of merchandise, like t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, coffee mug, water bottle sticker, or a shirt. Or maybe you'd like one of our knife math shirts, or a hoodie featuring a man without a knife is a man without a life. Whatever you fancy in knife-related merchandise, the Knife Junkie has it for you. Go to theknifejunkie.com/shop. That's theknifejunkie.com/shop.
Do you like the sound of the alpha numeric combinations M390, 204P, and 20CV, but bristle at 8CR13MOV and AUS-8? You are a knife junkie. Probably worse.
Very, very exciting. Well, always good to see Ian, of course. But this Mac Crusade is exciting because it's something we talk about a lot here. This idea of more production style knives being made in the United States, I'm going to have to do more looking into it. Really wouldn't mind having myself a Mac Crusade in the future. So we'll see all about that. Anyway, check us out next week for another great interview and Wednesday for the midweek supplemental where we go over new knives in my collection and other stuff. And then Thursday Night Knives, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, live here on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, for Jim working his magic behind the switcher, I'm Bob DeMarco saying, don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to Bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.